they might be overlooked. He pried up a board on his cell floor and hid the diary underneath. With daily room inspections, discovery was likely, and would probably bring a clubbing. But this small declaration of self mattered a great deal to Louis. He knew that he might well die here. He wanted to leave a testament to what he had endured and who he had been. After food, what every man wanted most was war news. The Japanese sealed their camps from outside information and went to some lengths to convince their captives of Allied annihilation, first by trumpeting Japanese victories, and later, when victories stopped coming, by inventing stories of Allied losses and ridiculously implausible Japanese feats. Once they announced that their military had shot Abraham Lincoln and torpedoed Washington, D.C. "They couldn't understand why we laughed," said a prisoner. Ofuna officials had no idea that the captives had found ways to follow the war in spite of them. New captives were fonts of information, and no sooner had they arrived than their minds were picked clean, the news tapping its way down the cell blocks in minutes. Newspapers rarely appeared, but when one did, stealing it became a camp-wide obsession. Rations were sometimes delivered to camp wrapped in newspapers, and the two kitchen laborers, Al Meade and Ernest Duva, would quietly pocket them. The boldest men even managed to pinch papers from the interrogation room as they were being questioned. Once stolen, the papers made elaborate secret journeys, passed hand to hand until they reached the translators Harris, Fitzgerald, and Marr. As translations were done, lookouts stood by, pretending to tie their shoes or adjust their belts. When guards neared, warnings were issued, and the papers vanished, soon to be put to their final use. In a camp with a lot of dysentery and little toilet paper, newspapers were priceless. In a secret place inside his cell, Harris stored the tools of his clandestine translating trade. Sometime during his stay at Ofuna, he had scavenged or stolen bits of wire and string, strips of cardboard, scraps of paper, and a pencil. The cardboard had been cut from a Canadian Red Cross POW relief package. Because the Red Cross didn't know of Ofuna's existence, the package had probably been brought from another camp by the Japanese, who routinely purloined the contents of such parcels for their own consumption. Cutting or tearing the paper into small pages, Harris had used the wire and string to bind them into two books, sewing on the cardboard as covers. In one book, Harris had recorded the addresses of his fellow captives, including Louis. In the other, he had begun creating an elaborate Japanese-English dictionary. Inside, he had written sentences in Japanese and English. "I feel like eating melon. Don't you intend to buy a piano?" Followed by notes on proper phrasing, verbs, and tenses. Other pages were devoted to a comprehensive list of translations of military terms, words like torpedo plane, tank, bomber, anti-aircraft gun, and captive. In creating the dictionary, Harris may have had more in mind than translating stolen documents. If he ever escaped from Ofuna, the Japanese translations of words like compass, seacoast, and ashore might be critical to know. Along with the books, Harris kept a collection of hand-drawn war maps. He'd seen the original maps in stolen newspapers, memorized them, and recreated them. He stored all of these items, along with a newspaper clipping, in a small bag that he kept carefully hidden from the guards. Thanks to the work of thieves and translators, most captives were well enough informed on the war's progress that they had wagers riding on when it would end. Knowing that the Allies were winning was immensely inspiring, enabling men to go on a little longer. Though the captives' resistance was dangerous, through such acts, dignity was preserved, and through dignity, life itself. Everyone knew what the consequences would be if anyone were caught stealing newspapers or hiding items as incriminating as Harris's maps and dictionary. At the time, it seemed worth the risk. In the fall, the snow came, gliding through the gaps in the barracks walls. During the morning mopping, the water in the aisle froze. Nearly every captive fell ill. Louis, still wearing only the clothes he'd crashed in, developed an ominous cough. Shut outside all day, he and the others stood in large huddles, mixing slowly to give each man time in the middle, where it was warmest. The rations dwindled. The central authorities were allotting scant food to Ofuna, but this wasn't the half of it. Unloading the ration trucks, Captives saw beans, vegetables, and other nutritious fare, yet at mealtime these items were almost never in their bowls. Camp officials, including the commander, were stealing them. The most flagrant thief was the cook, a ringlet-haired civilian known as Curly. Curly would stand in full view of the captives as he hoisted their food over the fence to civilians, or packed it onto his bicycle and pedaled off to sell it on the black market, where it would bring astronomical prices. Sometimes he'd call Louis over, give him a package of the captive's food, and order him to walk it over to the fence, where a woman would take it in exchange for barter payment. According to one captive, it was widely known that Curly had bought and furnished a house with his profits. The stealing left Ofuna in a state of famine. "To give you an idea of how hungry we were," wrote Commander Fitzgerald, "it can best be explained by the fact that it took an awful lot of willpower to take the last part of starch from my rice bowl in order to stick a snapshot of my wife to a piece of plywood." Commander Marr pleaded for more food. Officials punished his impertinence by slashing the prisoners' rations and intensifying their exercise. In search of something to occupy their hungry mouths, the captives were seized by a mania for smoking. Small allotments of foul tobacco were handed out, and Louis, like almost all captives, resumed the habit. Men became fiercely addicted. The few who didn't smoke still received the tobacco ration. They were richer than kings. One of Louis's friends, an aging Norwegian sailor named Anton Minsas, became so hooked that he began trading his food for smokes. Louis urged him to eat, but Minsas couldn't be persuaded. He grew ever thinner. Every man in camp was thin, many emaciated, but Louis and Phil were thinner than anyone else. The rations weren't nearly enough, and Louis was plagued by dysentery. He couldn't get warm, and he was racked by a cough. He teetered through the exercise sessions, trying to keep his legs from buckling. At night, he folded his paper blankets to create loft, but it barely helped. The unheated, drafty rooms were only a few degrees warmer than the frigid outside air. When camp officials staged a baseball game, Louis was sent to bat. He hit the ball, took one step, and collapsed. Sprawled on the ground, he heard laughing. One day that fall, a Japanese newspaper editor came to camp. He had learned that a Louis Zamperini was being held there. In Japan, track was wildly popular, and international running stars were well known. The editor carried a file full of information on Louis and showed it to the guards. The guards were fascinated to learn that the sick, emaciated man in the first barracks had once been an Olympic runner. They quickly found a Japanese runner and brought him in for a match race against the American. Hauled out and forced to run, Louis was trounced, and the guards made tittering mockery of him. Louis was angry and shaken, and his growing weakness scared him. POWs were dying by the thousands in camps all over Japan and its captured territories, and winter was coming. Louis went to Sasaki to ask for help. Since Sasaki was, by his own account, a bigwig, it seemed that it would be easy for him to intervene. But after talking about what we would do, Sasaki never followed through. The most he did for Louis was to give him an egg and a tangerine, which Louis shared with other captives. Louis began to believe that Sasaki wasn't his ally and wasn't protecting him from interrogation. It now seemed that the Japanese simply weren't interested in what he knew. They had brought him to Ofuna to soften him up for something else, but he had no idea what it was. Where Sasaki failed Louis, the kitchen workers, Mead and Duva, came through at considerable risk to themselves. Each day, as they walked the barracks hall to deliver rations, they boiled up an extra portion of rice and sometimes a bit of fish, waited for a moment when the guards glanced away, and tossed it to Louis. Mead whispered his only request, "Give half to Phil." Louis would hide half the rice, inch up to Phil on the parade ground, and slip it into his hand. In October, Anton Minsas, still trading his food for cigarettes, sank to the ground during an exercise session. The guards dropped on him, clubs flying. Not long after, beriberi set in, and Minsas became too weak to walk, then could no longer speak. Camp officials brought in a doctor who injected Minsas with a green fluid. Minsas died immediately. Of the green fluid, Captain Johan Arthur Johansson wrote, "We believed that it was an attempt to end his life." Louis sat in his cell, shivering and praying. A Norwegian sailor, Thorbjørn Christensen, felt for him and gave him a gift that may well have saved his life. Digging through his possessions, he pulled out a coat and passed it to Louis. Louis bundled up, hung on, and hoped he wouldn't end up like Minsas. As 1943 drew to its end, the men in Ofuna had a taste of liberation. The veteran captives, Louis included, were allowed to speak to one another when they were outside. When new captives arrived, they were whisked into solitary confinement and banned from speaking until they were done with the initial interrogation. Veterans began loitering outside the new men's windows, pretending to speak to each other, when in fact they were grilling the neophytes. In the early weeks of 1944, Louis got word that a new captive, just out of solitary, was looking for him. When he tracked the man down, he found a wavy-haired blonde from Burbank, not far from Torrance. One of the man's legs was gone, his pant leg tied above the knee. He introduced himself as Fred Garrett, a B-24 pilot. He seemed amazed to see Louis. As Louis listened, Garrett told a remarkable story. Before Christmas, the Americans had gone after the Japanese bases in the Marshall Islands, sending waves of bombers. Flying on one such mission, Garrett was shot down over the ocean, incurring a compound ankle fracture. After floating for 10 hours on a raft, he was picked up by a Japanese tugboat crew. They took him to an island, where Japanese soldiers took turns kicking his dangling ankle. Then, Garrett was flown to another island and thrown into a cell block where 19 other downed American airmen were being held. His ankle festered, maggots hatched in it, and Garrett began to run a high fever. He was told that he'd be given medical care only if he divulged military secrets. If not, he'd be killed. Garrett lied in interrogation, and the Japanese knew it. 2 days after Christmas, Garrett was tied down, given a spinal anesthetic, and forced to watch as a Japanese corpsman sawed at his leg, then snapped it off. Though the infection was limited to the ankle, the corpsman cut the entire leg off, because, he told Garrett, this would make it impossible for him to fly a plane again. Garrett, delirious, was dumped back in his cell. The next morning he was thrown onto a truck and taken toward mainland Japan with two other captives. Their journey brought them to Ofuna. The 17 Americans who were left behind were never seen again. Garrett then told Louis why he had sought him out. As he had lain in fevered agony in his cell on the second island, he had looked up to see 10 names scratched into the wall. He asked about them, and had been told that the first 9 men had been executed. No one had told him what happened to the 10th man. Garrett had spent much of his time mulling over that last name on the wall, perhaps thinking that if this man had survived, so might he. When he had arrived at Ofuna, he had asked if anyone had heard of that man, Louis Zamperini. Garrett and Zamperini, both Los Angeles area natives, had been held in the same tiny quadrilane cell, almost 5,000 miles from home. Plodding around the parade ground that winter, Louis and Harris befriended Frank Tinker, a dive bomber pilot and opera singer, who had been brought from Kwajalein with Garrett. The three spent most of their outdoor time together, sitting on benches or tracing the edges of the compound, distracting one another from the tooth-chattering cold with mind exercises. Harris and Tinker were experiencing the sparkling mental clarity prompted by starvation that Louis had first known on the raft. Tinker became conversant in Norwegian in a single week, taking lessons from his cell neighbors. He saw Harris arguing with another captive about medieval history in the Magna Carta, and he once found the Marine sitting with his hands parted as if holding a book, staring at them and mumbling to himself. When Tinker asked what he was doing, Harris said he was reading a text that he had studied at Annapolis many years earlier. Harris could see the book in front of him, as if its words were written across his outspread fingers. With the help of Christensen's coat, Duva and Meade's rice, and Harris, Tinker, and Garrett's friendship, Louis survived the winter. Buoyed by the extra calories, he strengthened his legs, lifting his knees up and down as he walked the compound. The guards began goading him into running around the compound alone. When spring arrived, Ofuna officials brought in a Japanese civilian and ordered Louis to race him. Louis didn't want to do it, but he was told that if he refused, all captives would be punished. The race was about a mile and a half, in laps around the compound. Louis had no intention of winning, and lagged behind for most of it. But as he ran, he found that his body was so light that carrying it was surprisingly easy. All around the compound, the captives watched him, breathless. As the finish approached, they started cheering. Louis looked ahead at the Japanese runner and realized that he had it within himself to pass the man. He knew what would happen if he won, but the cheering and the accumulation of so many months of humiliation brought something in him to a hard point. He lengthened his stride, seized the lead, and crossed the finish line. The captives whooped. Louis didn't see the club coming at his skull. He just felt the world tip and go away. His eyes opened to the sight of the sky, ringed with the faces of captives. It had been worth it. The guards thought they had taught him a lesson. Another runner, his girlfriend in tow, arrived. Louis was ready to beat him too, but before the race, the runner spoke to him kindly, in English, offering to give him a rice ball if he'd throw the race. It would mean a lot to him, he said, to win in front of his girlfriend. Louis lost, the girlfriend was impressed, and the runner delivered one rice ball, plus a second as interest. The payment, Louis said, made me a professional. In March, Phil was taken away. It seemed that he had at last gotten lucky. Officials said that he was being sent to a POW camp called Zensuji. Every captive longed to be transferred to a POW camp, where, it was said, men were registered with the Red Cross and could write home and enjoy vastly better living conditions. Of all POW camps, Zensuji was rumored to be the best. The interrogators had long dangled this plush camp for the captives as a reward for cooperation. Phil and Louis had only a brief goodbye. They spoke of finding each other again someday when the war was over. Phil was led through the gate and driven away. The Zensuji story was false. Phil was sent to Ashio, a camp north of Tokyo. The POWs of Ashio were handed over to a wire and cable firm, which herded them underground to mine copper in conditions that were almost unlivable. This work was usually, but not always, restricted to enlisted POWs. Whether or not Phil was forced into slavery is unknown. There was, it seemed, one good thing about Ashio. Phil hadn't seen Cece or his family in well over 2 years, and knew that they probably thought he was dead. At Ashio, he was told that he could write home. Given paper and pen, he wrote about his days on the life raft with Zamp, his capture, and his yearning for home. "The first night home, we'll hear some interesting tales," he wrote. "Much love, till we're together again. Al." Sometime after Phil turned in his letter, someone found it in a garbage heap, burned. Though the edges were charred, the text was still visible. Phil took back his letter and tucked it away. If he got out of this war alive, he'd deliver it in person. Chapter 21. Belief. Behind Torrance High School stood a huddle of trees. On many evenings in the months after her brother went missing, Sylvia Zamperini Flammer would drive to the school, turn her car onto the trees, and park there, then sit in the quiet and the dimness, alone. As the car cooled over the pavement, tears would stream down Sylvia's cheeks. Sometimes she'd let herself sob, knowing that no one would hear her. After a few minutes, she'd dab away her tears, straighten herself, and start the car again. On the drive home, she'd think of a lie to explain why her post office trip had again taken so long. She never let anyone know how frightened she was. In Torrance, the June 4, 1943 telegram announcing Louis's disappearance was followed by excruciating silence. Many weeks passed, and the military search yielded no trace of Louis, his crew, or his plane. In town, hope dissolved. When the Zamperinis went out, they saw resignation in their neighbors' faces. Inside the White House on Gramercy Avenue, the mood was different. In the first days after the telegram arrived, Louise Zamperini had been seized with the conviction that her son was alive. Her husband and children had felt the same. Days passed, then weeks. Spring became summer, and no word came. But the family's conviction remained unshaken. To the family, Louis was among them still, spoken of in the present tense, as if he was just down the street, expected at any moment. What the Zamperinis were experiencing wasn't denial. And it wasn't hope. It was belief. Louise, Anthony, Pete, and Virginia still sensed Louis' presence. They could still feel him. Their distress came not from grief, but from the certainty that Louis was out there in trouble, and they couldn't reach him. On July 13th, Louise felt a wave of urgency. She penned a letter to Major General Willis Hale, commander of the 7th Air Force. In it, she begged Hale not to give up searching. Louis, she wrote, was alive. Unbeknownst to Louise, on that same day, Louis was captured. Several weeks later, a reply came from Hale's office. The letter said that given the failure of the search to yield any clues, the military had been forced to accept that Louis and the rest of the men on the plane were gone. It was hoped, the letter said, that Louise would accept this also. Louise ripped up the letter. Pete was still in San Diego, training Navy recruits. The stress wore on him. Sometimes he drove to Torrance to visit his family, and when he arrived, everyone quietly worried about how thin he was. In September, his last letter to Louis, mailed hours before his family was notified of his crash, came back to him. Scribbled on the front were the words, "Missing at sea." On the back there was a stamp, "Casualty status verified." The photograph of Pete was still sealed in the envelope. That same month, Sylvia's husband, Harvey, left for the war. He wouldn't see his wife again for 2 years. Living alone, Sylvia was racked with anxiety for her brother and her husband, and she had no one to share it with. Like Pete, she was barely able to eat. Her body had become a slender, taut line. Yearning to connect with someone, she decided to move back in with her parents. Sylvia held a yard sale to get rid of all her possessions. She had a clothes washer and dryer, both rationed items that were almost impossible to buy new. One woman wanted to buy them, but Sylvia refused in hopes that she could sell everything in one lot. The woman promptly bought the entire house's contents for $1,000 just to get the appliances. Sylvia took what little she had left and drove to Torrance. She found her father, just as he had been since the news had come. Chin up, smiling bravely, sometimes through tears. Virginia, living at home and building military ships at Western Pipe and Steel, was as distraught as Sylvia. Their mother was the biggest worry. At first, Louise cried often. Then, as the months passed, she hardened down. The weeping rash on her hands, which had appeared almost the moment she'd learned of Louise's disappearance, raged. She couldn't wear gloves and could no longer do anything with her hands. Sylvia and her father took over the cooking. Sylvia quit her job in a dentist's office and took a new one as a dental assistant in an army hospital, hoping that the job might give her access to information about Louis. There, she'd heard talk of a plane shortage in the military, so she took a second job, moonlighting on the evening shift in the blueprint office of an aircraft factory. She was almost unbearably tense. One night, leaving work late, she came upon a group of workers sitting under a plane, gambling. She suddenly found herself shouting at them, saying that her brother was missing, America needed planes, and here they were goofing off. Sylvia was startled by her outburst, but she didn't regret it. It made her feel better. On October 6th, Louis' army trunk bumped onto his parents' doorstep, heavy and final. Louise couldn't bring herself to look inside. She had it dragged to the basement and covered with a blanket. It would sit there, unopened, for the rest of her life. Everyone in the family was suffering, but the children wanted to insulate their mother. They never cried together, instead telling each other invented stories of Louis' adventures on a tropical island. Most of the time, Anthony simply couldn't talk about Louis. Sylvia spent a lot of time in church, praying for Louis and Harvey. Sometimes she and Virginia drove to San Diego to see Pete, and they'd all go out for a drink to cheer one another up. They never discussed the possibility that Louis was dead. When Sylvia walked through downtown Torrance with her family, she noticed oblique glances from passers-by. Their expressions seemed to say that they pitied the Zamperinis for being unable to accept the truth. Every evening, Sylvia wrote a letter to her husband. Every week or so, she wrote one to Louis. She made a point of writing as if everything were normal, sharing the trivial news of home. She had an address for Harvey. For Louis, she had nothing, so she addressed his letters to the Red Cross. She'd tell her mother that she was mailing letters, get in the car, drive to the post office, and drop the letters in the box. Then she'd drive to Torrance High, park under the trees, and cry. At night, when the lights were out and she was alone in her childhood bed, Sylvia often broke down again. When sleep came, it was fitful and haunted. Because she knew nothing of what had happened to her brother, her mind latched onto the image she had seen in the newspaper after Nauru, Louis peering through a hole in the side of Superman. The image had fixed in her mind the idea of Louis being shot, and this was the point around which her nightmare circled. Never a crash, never water, only bullets, bloodying Louis as he sat in his plane. Sylvia was always trying to get to Louis, but she was never able. As bad as the nightmares were, in them, Louis was never killed. Even Sylvia's imagination didn't allow for her brother's death. In December 1943, the family prepared to celebrate their first Christmas without Louis. The mailman knocked at the door each day to deliver a harvest of cards and letters, most of them offering sympathy. The holiday tree was strung with popcorn and cranberries, and beneath it sat a collection of gifts for Louis. The gifts would be tucked away in the belief that one day Louis would come home to open them himself. Louise bought a little Christmas card depicting a cherub in a red dress blowing a horn as she stood surrounded by lambs. Inside, she wrote a message. Dear Louis, wherever you are, I know you want us to think of you as well and safe. May God be with you and guide you. Love from all. Mother, Dad, Pete, Sylvia, and Virginia. Christmas, 2543. 2 months later, after a campaign of saturation bombing, America seized Kwajalein. The island's dense jungle had been bombed away. In its place were massive craters, burned tree stumps, and churned earth. The entire island looked as if it had been picked up 20,000 feet and then dropped, said one serviceman. In what was left of an administrative building, someone found a stack of documents. Outside, a serviceman, climbing through the remains of a wooden structure, saw something in the wreckage and dug it out. It was a long splinter of wood. Etched along the slat in capital letters was the name Louis Zamperini. On Oahu, Joe Deasy was summoned to Hickam Field. When he arrived, he was handed translations of some of the Japanese documents that had been taken from Kwajalein. He began to read. Two American airmen, the documents said, had been fished from a life raft and brought to Kwajalein. Their names weren't given, but they were described as a pilot and a bombardier. They'd been in a plane crash, the date was apparently provided, and three men had survived, but one had died on the raft. The other two had drifted for 47 days. Included among the papers were interrogation reports and drawings of B-24s made by the captives. The report stated that the men had been beaten, then sent to Japan by boat. The moment that Deasy read the report, he knew who the men were. Deasy had been long at war, and the experience had ground away his emotions, but this revelation broke through. Phillips and Zamperini had survived their crash. Deasy's elation was tailed by a sinking sense of guilt. In their painstaking search of the ocean, they had missed seeing the lost men. But the enemy had not. I was happy to have found them, Deasy recalled, but the next thing is, where the hell are they? If the report of their transport to Japan was correct, it still didn't mean they had gotten there alive, or that they had survived whatever lay in store for them there. The military now knew with a fair amount of certainty that everyone who had gone up on Green Hornet, with the exception of Zamperini and Phillips, was dead. Apparently, because of the sketchiness of the reports and the fact that Louis' and Phil's fates were still unknown, the families of the dead and the two still missing weren't notified. Like the Zamperinis, the Phillips family had been largely in the dark since Alan had disappeared. Alan's father was at Camp Pickett in Virginia. His mother, Kelsey, rattled around her empty house in Princeton, Indiana. After the telegram informing them that Alan was missing, they received a letter from an adjutant from the 42nd Squadron, giving details on how Alan had disappeared. The adjutant wrote with a tone of finality, speaking of your hour of grief, noting that Alan will always be revered by the members of this organization, and offering to extend myself to you to ease your sorrow. The next month, a package came to Alan's father at Camp Pickett. In it were two bronze oak leaf clusters, awarded to Alan for his valor in the missions of Macon, Tarawa, and Nauru. Pending final determination of your son's status, the cover letter read, the oak leaf clusters are being sent to you for safekeeping. Though the Phillipses didn't know it, the medals arrived the same week Alan was captured. Chaplain Phillips wanted to send the oak leaf clusters to his wife, but feared losing them in the mail, so he kept them with him in Virginia. He took a picture of them, along with Alan's service ribbons, wings, insignia, and air medal, attached the picture to a maroon piece of felt he'd cut from a lady's hat, and glued the felt to a walnut plaque. When he got back to Indiana, he planned to attach the actual medals and ribbons to the felt and stand the plaque on a bookcase under Alan's picture. "It certainly is swell," he wrote to his daughter. In the absence of information, all the Phillipses could do was ponder what little they knew. They, like the Zamperinis, refused to conclude that their boy was dead. "I think I have thought of every conceivable angle to what Alan did, and I have not dismissed any of them from my mind yet," Chaplain Phillips wrote to his daughter in August. "So many things could be true about it all that they build up for me a feeling of confidence that will not be shaken. Someday we are all going to have that reunion we are hoping and waiting for." For Cece Perry, the news that her fiancé was missing was followed by a letter from her old friend Smitty, one of the pilots who had searched for Green Hornet. In his letter, Smitty told Cece everything that was known about Alan's disappearance and how dedicated the searchers were to finding him. He didn't tell her that he had seen what had probably been the provisions box for the lost plane floating by itself on the ocean. He wrote about having sat with Alan on the night before he disappeared and how Alan had been thinking of her and hoping to get leave to see her. After Smitty's letter, no news came. Cece, desperate for information, felt isolated in Indiana. One of her friends was living in a suburb of Washington, D.C., and Cece thought that in the capital she could find out more about Alan. She gave up teaching, traveled east, and moved into her friend's apartment, which she decorated with pictures of Alan. She got a job with TWA, thinking that through the airlines she might learn something. She spent much of her time asking questions, but learned nothing. Cece was a sensible, educated woman, but in her anguish, she did something completely out of character. She went to a fortune teller and asked about Alan. The fortune teller told her that Alan wasn't dead. He was injured, but alive. He would be found, she said, before Christmas. Cece latched onto those words and believed them. By the spring of 1944, the mothers of the Green Hornet crewmen, as well as other family members, had begun to correspond. In dozens of letters that crisscrossed America, they shared their emotions and bolstered each other's hopes about our boys. Kelsey would later say that she came to love all of them through those letters. "This year sure has been an awful long year just waiting for some word from them," wrote Delia Robinson, the sister of Green Hornet gunner Otto Anderson, that June. "We just have to keep on hoping." The waiting had taken its toll on crewman Leslie Dean's mother, Mabel. Her failing health had sent her to Wichita for weeks of treatment, but she, like the others, had not given up. "We thought surely we would have heard something when the year was up," she wrote to Louise. "So it seems they are not sure the crew were killed, or they would have notified us long before this. So I feel that we can still have hope of them being alive somewhere." Mabel Dean wrote those words on June 27, 1944. On that very day, exactly 13 months after Green Hornet had gone down, messages were typed up at the War Department and sent to the families of the plane's crewmen. When Louise Zamperini's message reached her door, she opened it and burst into tears. The military had officially declared Louis and all the other crewmen dead. Kelsey Phillips was not persuaded. She either learned or guessed that the La Porte Herald Argus, the newspaper of their former hometown, would publish the news. She contacted the paper and asked them not to print the death notice. Her son, she told them, was not gone. The editors honored her request. Russell Alan Phillips had officially been declared dead, but no obituary appeared. The feeling in the Zamperini home was the same as in the Phillipses. When the initial shock from the death notice faded, all of the Zamperinis realized that it changed nothing. The notice had been generated as a bureaucratic matter of course, a designation made for all missing servicemen after 13 months had passed. Louis's official death date was listed as May 28, 1944, a year and a day after his plane had vanished. The notice was just a piece of paper. "None of us believed it, none of us," Sylvia would say. "Never once, not underneath, even." Inside themselves, the Zamperinis still felt that persistent little echo of Louis, the sense that he was still in the world somewhere. Until it was gone, they would go on believing that he was alive. During family dinners, Pete and his father began drawing up plans to hunt for Louis. When the war was over, they'd rent a boat and sail from island to island until they found him. They'd go on for as long as it took. Chapter 22. plots afoot. The plot began with a question. It was the summer of 1944, and Louis and Frank Tinker were walking together in the Ofuna compound. Louis could hear small planes coming and going from an airstrip somewhere in the distance, and the sound started him thinking. If we could get out of here, he asked Tinker, could you fly a Japanese plane?
If it has wings, Tinker replied.
From that brief exchange, an idea took root. Louis, Tinker, and Harris were going to escape. They'd been driven to this point by a long, desperate spring and summer. Every day, the men were slapped, kicked, beaten, humiliated, and driven through forced exercises. There were sudden explosions of violence that left captives spilled over the ground, hoping they wouldn't be killed. And that spring, the central authorities had cut rations to all prisoners dramatically. With only about half of the official ration ending up in the captives' bowls, the men were wasting away. When the Japanese weighed the captives, Bill Harris, over 6 feet tall, tipped the scale at 120 pounds. He had developed beriberi. Louis was driven to ever more reckless efforts to find food. He stole an onion and secretly cooked it under a water heater, but, divided between several men, it didn't amount to much. He stole a package of miso paste, and when the guards weren't looking, shoveled it into his mouth and swallowed it in one gulp, not knowing that miso paste is extremely concentrated, meant to be diluted in water. He was soon doubled over behind the barracks, heaving his guts out. He was so mad for food that he snuck from his cell late at night, broke into the kitchen, and crammed his mouth full of chestnuts that were to be served to the guards. When he looked up, Shithead was there, watching him. Louis backed away, then sprinted back to his cell. Shithead didn't beat him for it, but the guard's appearance was enough to scare Louis out of another go at the kitchen. The best he could do was volunteer to starch the guard's shirts. The starch was made from rice water pressed through cloth. After Louis pressed the rice, he spent the rest of his time picking flecks of it off the cloth and eating them. Finally, opportunity knocked. Camp officials asked for a volunteer to work as barber for the guards, offering payment of one rice ball per job. The idea of working around the guards was intimidating, but Louis had to eat. When he came forward, he was given not just electric clippers, but a straight razor. He'd never used one before, and he knew what the guards would do to him if they were nicked. He took the razor to his cell and practiced on himself until he could shave without drawing blood. When he walked out to do his first job, the guard balled up his fist at him, then made a demand that to an American seemed bizarre. He wanted his forehead shaved, a standard barbering practice in Japan. All of the guards expected Louis to do this. Louis managed not to cut anyone, and the rice balls kept him alive. A notoriously cruel guard called the Weasel began coming to Louis for shaves, but every time he left without paying. Louis knew what he would risk in evening the score, but he couldn't resist. While shaving the weasel's forehead, he let the blade stray a little low. By the time he was done, all that was left of the weasel's bushy eyebrows was a coquettish line. The weasel stood, left without paying, and entered the guardhouse. A moment later, Louis heard a shout, "Marlena Dietrich!" Louis backed away, waiting for the weasel to burst out. Several other guards went into the guardhouse, and Louis could hear laughing. The weasel never punished Louis, but the next time he needed to shave, he went elsewhere. For the captives, every day was lived with the knowledge that it could be their last. The nearer the Allies came to Japan, the larger loomed the threat of the kill-all order. The captives had only a vague idea of how the war was going, but the Japanese were clearly worried. In an interrogation session in late spring, an official told Fitzgerald that if Japan lost, the captives would be executed. "Hope for Japan's victory," he said. The quest for news of the war took on special urgency. One morning, Louis was on the parade ground under orders to sweep the compound. He saw the mummy, the camp commander, sitting under a cherry tree holding a newspaper. He was nodding off. Louis loitered near him, watching. The mummy's head tipped, his fingers parted, and the paper fluttered to the ground. Louis swept his way over, reached out with the broom, and, as quietly as he could, forked the newspaper to himself. The text was in Japanese, but there was a war map on one page. Louis ran to the barracks, found Harris, and held the paper up before him. Harris stared at it, memorizing the map. Louis then ran the paper to the garbage,
so they'd have no evidence of the theft. Harris drew a perfect rendering of the map, showed it to the other captives, then destroyed it. The map confirmed that the Allies were closing in on Japan. In July, the scuttlebutt in camp was that the Americans were attacking the critical island of Saipan in the Mariana Islands, south of mainland Japan. A spindly new captive was hauled in, and everyone eyed him as a source of information, but the guards kept him isolated and forbade the veterans from speaking to him. When the new man was led to the bathhouse, Louis saw his chance. He snuck behind the building and looked in an open window. The captive was standing naked, holding a pan of water and washing as the guard stood by. Then the guard stepped away to light a cigarette. "If we've taken Saipan, drop the pan," Louis whispered. The pan clattered to the floor. The captive picked it up and dropped it again, then did it a third time. The guard rushed back in, and the captive pretended that the pan had accidentally slipped. Louis hurried to his friends and announced that Saipan had fallen. At the time of their capture, the American bomber with the longest range was the B-24. Because the Liberator didn't have the range to make the 3,000-mile round trip between Saipan and Japan's home islands, the captives must have believed that winning Saipan was only a preliminary step to establishing an island base within bomber range of mainland Japan. They didn't know that the AAF had introduced a new bomber, one with tremendous range. From Saipan, the Japanese mainland was already within reach. The guards and officials were increasingly agitated. Sasaki had long crowed about the inevitability of Japan's victory, but now he buddied up to the captives, telling Louis of his hatred of former Prime Minister and war architect Hideki Tojo. He began to sound like he was rooting for the Allies. As they considered the news on Saipan, Louis and the others had no idea what horrors were attending the Allied advance. That same month, American forces turned on Saipan's neighboring isle, Tinian, where the Japanese held 5,000 Koreans conscripted as laborers. Apparently afraid that the Koreans would join the enemy if the Americans invaded, the Japanese employed the kill-all policy. They murdered all 5,000 Koreans. At night, as they lay in their cells, the captives began hearing an unsettling sound far in the distance. It was the scream of air raid sirens. They listened for bombers, but none came. As summer stretched on, conditions in Ofuna declined. The air was clouded with flies, lice hopped over scalps, and wiggling lines of fleas ran the length of the seams in Louis's shirt. Louis spent his days and nights scratching and slapping, and his skin, like that of everyone else, was speckled with angry bite marks. The Japanese offered a rice ball to the man who killed the most flies, inspiring a cutthroat swatting competition and hoarding of flattened corpses. Then, in July, the men were marched outside and into a canal to bale water into rice paddies. When they emerged at the day's end, they were covered in leeches. Louis had six on his chest alone. The men became frantic, begging the guards for their cigarettes. As they squirmed around, jabbing at the leeches with cigarettes, one of the guards looked down at them. "You should be happy in your work," he said. On August 5th, a truck bearing the month's rations arrived. As Fitzgerald watched, camp officials stripped it nearly clean. Curley announced that the rations were again being cut, blaming it on rats. Fitzgerald noted in his diary that after officials were done brown bagging their way through the 70 pounds of sugar allotted to the captives, one teacup of sugar remained. On August 22nd, a truck backed up to the kitchen door, and the captive kitchen workers were told to leave. Fitzgerald went to the benjo, from which he could see the kitchen. He saw sacks of food being piled into the truck, which then left camp. "Someone must be opening up a store and really getting set up in business," he wrote. The beatings went on. The quack was especially feral. One day, Louis saw some Japanese dumping fish into the trough in which the captives washed their hands and feet. Told to wash the fish, Louis walked up and peered into the trough. The fish were putrid and undulating with maggots. As he recoiled, the quack saw him, pounded over, and punched him a dozen times. That night, the same fish was ladled into Louis's bowl. Louis wouldn't touch it. A guard jabbed him behind the ear with a bayonet and forced him to eat it. And then there was Gaga. Something about this affectionate little duck, perhaps the fact that he was beloved to the captives, provoked the guards. They tortured him mercilessly, kicking him and hurling him around. Then one day, in full view of the captives, Shithead opened his pants and violated the bird. Gaga died. Of all the things he witnessed in war, Louis would say, this was the worst. Louis's mind fled Ofuna and carried him home. He hadn't seen his family in 2 years. He thought of the little white house, Virginia and Sylvia, his father and dear, devoted Pete. Most poignant were his memories of his mother. Fred Garrett had told Louis that he'd been given up for dead. Louis couldn't bear the thought of what this news must have done to his mother. It was the accumulation of so much suffering, the tug of memory, and the conviction that the Japanese wouldn't let them leave Ofuna alive, that led Louis to listen to the nearby planes and wonder if they could be a way out. Examining the fence, he, Tinker, and Harris concluded that it might be possible to get around the guards and over the barbed wire. The thought hooked all three of them. They decided to make a run for it, commandeer a plane, and get out of Japan. At first, their plans hit a dead end. They'd been brought in blindfolded and had ventured out of camp only briefly to irrigate the rice paddies, so they knew little about the area. They didn't know where the airport was or how they'd steal a plane. Then a kind guard inadvertently helped them. Thinking that they might enjoy looking at a book, he gave them a Japanese almanac. Harris cracked it open and was immediately rapt. The book was full of detailed information on Japan's ports, the ships in its harbors and the fuels they used, and the distances between cities and landmarks. It was everything they needed to craft an escape. In hours spent poring over the book, they shaped a plan. They discarded the plane idea in favor of escape by boat. Just a few miles to the east was the port of Yokohama, only there was nowhere to go from there. But if they crossed Japan to the western shore, they could get to a port that would offer a good route to safety. They'd go on foot. Harris plotted a path across the island, a walk of about 150 miles. It would be dangerous, but Harris's earlier experience of hiking all over the Bataan Peninsula gave them confidence. Once at a port, they'd steal a powerboat and fuel, cross the Sea of Japan, and flee into China. Given that Louis had drifted 2,000 miles on a hole-riddled raft with virtually no provisions, a few hundred miles on the Sea of Japan in a sturdy, powered boat seemed manageable. Tinker, who'd been captured more recently than Harris and Louis, had the most current knowledge of which areas of China were occupied by the enemy. He worked out a route that they hoped would steer them clear of the Japanese. They counted on finding safe harbor in China. In 1942, America had launched its first and, until recently, only bombing raid on Japan's home islands. The raid had used B-25s, flown perilously off an aircraft carrier under command of Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. After bombing Japan, some of the Doolittle crews had run out of gas and crashed or bailed out over China. Civilians had hidden the airmen from the Japanese, who'd ransacked the country in search of them. Harris, Tinker, and Louis had heard rumors that the Japanese had retaliated against Chinese civilians for sheltering the Doolittle men, but didn't know the true extent of it. The Japanese had murdered an estimated 250,000 civilians. There was one problem that the men didn't know how to overcome. When they stood near the guards, it was impossible not to notice how much the Americans differed from typical Japanese people, and not simply in facial features. The average Japanese soldier was 5'3". Louis was 5'10", Tinker 6 feet, Harris even taller. Hiking across Japan, they'd be extremely conspicuous. China might be welcoming, but in Japan it would be foolish to assume that they'd find friendly civilians. After the war, some POWs would tell of heroic Japanese civilians who snuck them food and medicine, incurring ferocious beatings from guards when they were caught. But this behavior was not the rule. POWs led through cities were often swarmed by civilians who beat them, struck them with rocks, and spat on them. If Louis, Harris, and Tinker were caught, they would almost certainly be killed, either by civilians or by the authorities. Unable to remedy the height difference, they decided to move only at night and hope for the best. If they were going to die in Japan, at least they could take a path that they, and not their captors, chose, declaring in this last act of life that they remained sovereign over their own souls. As the plan took shape, the prospective escapees walked as much as possible, strengthening their legs. They studied the guards' shifts, noting that there was a patch of time at night when only one guard watched the fence. Louis stole supplies for the journey. His barber job gave him access to tools, and he was able to make off with a knife. He stole miso paste and rice. He gathered bits of loose paper that flitted across the compound to be used for toilet paper, and every strand of loose string he could find. He stashed all of it under a floorboard in his cell. For 2 months, the men prepared. As the date of escape neared, Louis was filled with what he called a fearful joy. Just before the getaway date, an event occurred that changed everything. At one of the POW camps, a prisoner escaped. Ofuna officials assembled the men and issued a new decree. Anyone caught escaping would be executed, and for every escapee, several captive officers would be shot. Louis, Tinker, and Harris suspended their plan. With the escape off, Louis and Harris channeled their energy into the captive information network. At the beginning of September, a captive saw a newspaper lying on the quack's desk. There was a war map printed in it. Few things were more dangerous than stealing from the quack, but given the threat of mass executions upon an Allied invasion, the captives were willing to do almost anything to get news. Only one man had the thieving experience for a job this risky. For several days, Louis staked out the quack's office, peeking in windows to watch him and the guards. At a certain time each day, they'd go into the office for tea, walk out together to smoke, then return. The length of their cigarette break never varied. 3 minutes. This was Louis's only window of opportunity, and it was going to be a very, very close call. With Harris in place, Louis loitered by the quack's office, waiting for his moment. The quack and the guards stepped out, cigarettes in hand. Louis crept around the side of the building, dropped onto all fours so that he wouldn't be seen through the windows, and crawled into the office. The newspaper was still there, sitting on the desk. Louis snatched the paper, stuck it under his shirt, then crawled back out, rose to his feet, and walked to Harris's cell, striding as quickly as he could without attracting attention. He opened the paper and showed it to Harris, who stared at it for several seconds. Then Louis crammed it under his shirt again and sped back to the quack's office. His luck had held. The quack and the guards were still outside. He went back down on all fours, hurried in, threw the paper on the desk, and fled. No one had seen him. At the barracks, Harris pulled out a strip of toilet paper and a pencil and drew the map. The men all looked at it. Memories later differed as to the subject of the map, but everyone recalled that it showed Allied progress. Harris hid the map among his belongings. In the late afternoon of September 9th, Harris was sitting in a cell with another captive discussing the war, when the quack swept into the doorway. Harris hadn't heard him coming. The quack noticed something in Harris's hand, stepped in, and snatched it. It was the map. The quack studied the map. On it, he saw the words Philippine and Taiwan. He demanded that Harris tell him what it was. Harris replied that it was idle scribbling. The quack wasn't fooled. He went to Harris's cell, ransacked it, and found, by his account, a trove of hand-drawn maps, some showing air defenses of mainland Japan, as well as the stolen newspaper clipping and the dictionary of military terms. The quack called in an officer, who spoke to Harris, then left. Everyone thought that the issue was resolved. That night, the quack abruptly called all captives into the compound. He looked strange, his face crimson. He ordered the men to do push-ups for about 20 minutes, then adopt the Ofuna crouch. Then he told Harris to step forward. Louis heard the Marine whisper, "Oh my God, my map." The men who witnessed what followed would never blot it from memory. Screeching and shrieking, the quack attacked Harris, kicking him, punching him, and clubbing him with a wooden crutch that he took from an injured captive. When Harris collapsed, his nose and shins streaming blood, the quack ordered other captives to hold him up, and the beating resumed. For 45 minutes, perhaps an hour, the beating went on, long past when Harris fell unconscious. Two captives fainted. At last, raindrops began to patter over the dirt, the quack and the body beneath him. The quack paused. He dropped the crutch, walked to a nearby building, leaned against its wall, and slid languidly to the ground, panting. As the guards dragged Harris to his cell, Louis followed. The guards jammed Harris in a seated position against the wall, then left. There Harris sat, eyes wide open, but blank as stones. It was 2 hours before he moved. Slowly, in the coming days, he began to revive. He was unable to feed himself, so Louis sat with him, helping him eat and trying to speak with him. But Harris was so dazed that he could barely communicate. When he finally emerged from his cell, he wandered through camp, his face grotesquely disfigured, his eyes glassy. When his friends greeted him, he didn't know who they were. 3 weeks later, on the morning of September 30th, 1944, the guards called the names of Zamperini, Tinker, Duva, and several other men. The men were told that they were going to a POW camp called Omori, just outside of Tokyo. They had 10 minutes to gather their things. Louis hurried to his cell and lifted the floorboard. He pulled out his diary and tucked it into the folds of his clothing. At a new camp, a body search would be inevitable, so he left his other treasures for the next captive to find. He said goodbye to his friends, among them Harris, still floating in concussed misery. Sasaki bid Louis a friendly farewell, offering some advice. If interrogated, stick to the story he told on Kwajalein. A few minutes later, after a year and 15 days in Ofuna, Louis was driven from camp. As the truck rattled out of the hills, he was euphoric. Ahead of him lay a POW camp, a promised land. Chapter 23. Monster. It was late morning on the last day of September 1944. Louis, Frank Tinker, and a handful of other Ofuna veterans stood by the front gate of the Omori POW camp, which sat on an artificial island in Tokyo Bay. The island was nothing more than a sandy spit connected to shore by a tenuous thread of bamboo slats. Across the water was the bright bustle of Tokyo, still virtually untouched by the war. Other than the patches of early snow scattered over the ground like hopscotch squares, every inch of the camp was an ashen, otherworldly gray, reminding one POW of the moon. There were no birds anywhere. They were standing before a small office, where they'd been told to wait. In front of them, standing beside the building, was a Japanese corporal. He was leering at them. He was a beautifully crafted man, a few years short of 30. His face was handsome, with full lips that turned up slightly at the edges, giving his mouth a faintly cruel expression. Beneath his smartly tailored uniform, his body was perfectly balanced, his torso radiating power, his form trim. A sword angled elegantly off his hip, and circling his waist was a broad webbed belt embellished with an enormous metal buckle. The only incongruities on this striking corporal were his hands, huge, brutish, animal things that one man would liken to paws. Louis and the other prisoners stood at attention, arms stiff, hands flat to their sides. The corporal continued to stare, but said nothing. Near him stood another man who wore a second lieutenant's insignia, yet hovered about the lower-ranking corporal with eager servility. 5, perhaps 10 minutes passed, and the corporal never moved. Then, abruptly, he swept toward the prisoners, the second lieutenant scurrying behind. He walked with his chin high and his chest puffed, his gestures exaggerated and imperious. He began to inspect the men with an air of possession, looking them over, Louis thought, as if he were God himself. Down the line the corporal strode, pausing before each man, raking his eyes over them, and barking, "Name!" When he reached Louis, he stopped. Louis gave his name. The corporal's eyes narrowed. Decades after the war, men who had looked into those eyes would be unable to shake the memory of what they saw in them, a wrongness that elicited a twist in the gut, a prickle up the back of the neck. Louis dropped his eyes. There was a rush in the air, the corporal's arms swinging, then a fist thudding into Louis's head. Louis staggered. "Why you no look in my eye?" the corporal shouted. The other men in the line went rigid. Louis steadied himself. He held his face taut as he raised his eyes to the corporal's face. Again came the whirling arm, the jarring blow into his skull, his stumbling legs trying to hold him upright. "You no look at me!" "This man," thought Tinker, "is a psychopath." The corporal marched the men to a quarantine area where there stood a rickety canopy. He ordered the men to stand beneath it, then left. Hours passed. The men stood, the cold working its way up their sleeves and pant legs. Eventually, they sat down. The morning gave way to a long, cold afternoon. The corporal didn't come back. Louis saw a wooden apple box lying nearby. Remembering his Boy Scout friction fire training, he grabbed the box and broke it up. He asked one of the other men, To unthread the lace from his boot, he fashioned a spindle out of a bamboo stick, fit it into a hole in a slat from the apple box, wound the boot lace around the spindle, and began alternately pulling the ends